He's back. I think David Robson is the second guest I've had on a second time, the first being female Mormon psychopath Emmy Thomas. I've done a couple of two-parters otherwise, like with Chris Ryan and Sadia Hamid, but in terms of having someone back on to talk about a new work, this is a first. So welcome to this, the 89th episode of On the Edge with Andrew Gold. I've been expecting you. And I'll be talking all about those expectations in the coming hour with award-winning science writer David Robson, whose work has appeared in The Guardian, The Atlantic, Eon, and many, many others. He was features editor at New Scientist for 5 years before working as a senior journalist at BBC Future. Last time, he was on to discuss his Intelligence Trap, a book I bring up on the podcast all the time because it's all about how some of the cleverest people make the biggest mistakes. A famous example being Sherlock Holmes writer Arthur Conan Doyle, who believed in fairies. So if he could believe something like that, what cognitive biases might you and I hold? And we don't even know about them. Who knows? But now David Robson is back with the expectation effect, which is why I said all that stuff about I've been expecting you and expectations. His book's called The Expectation Effect, another vivid trip into the fallacies and complexities of the human psyche. The book is a roaring success that documents all sorts of ways that our expectations alone can have very real effects on outcomes, whether it be lifespans, illnesses, or anything else. So maybe try and think positively. Anyway, he'll tell us all about that, and please do sign up on patreon.com/AndrewGold or on Apple subscribers to listen to the bonus episode. Next week is one of my all-time heroes, someone I looked up to as a young writer and journalist, and someone without whom I might not be in this business and this podcast might not exist. And that's John Ronson of The Psychopath Test. That was me just doing his voice. He's got a very distinct voice, which is beautiful, I think. He's the writer of So You've Been Publicly Shamed as well, Psychopath Test, and many books and films. And then it'll be author of The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins. I already did the interview, as I have done for John as well. Dawkins was very, very scary. And then Jordan Harbinger, who I've spoken to as well, will be in among the mix quite soon. But now, it's the wonderful David Robson. Nice tinsel and everything. You got it all kicking off.
Yeah. I mean, we're moving house soon, actually. So it's all a bit last minute, like the Christmas decorations. But, I just wanted to do something. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to do something as well. And then my girlfriend's going to be away for Christmas. And I thought, it's just me and the tree. What's the point?
Oh, no. That's a shame. But, I mean, are you going away in January, you said?
Yes, I'm going to join her. Then. She's going in a couple of weeks. She's going in 1 week to Argentina to see her family. They're all from Argentina. So she'll be there for 6 weeks. And then I'll go out like mid-January. So where are you guys based? Oh, where are you moving to?
We're not moving far. We're in Stratford at the moment. And we're moving to West Ham. So, okay. You know, it's not like a step up in the world necessarily.
I thought it was Stratford and West Ham is the same thing in my mind. Because I just think of the football team and I think that's in Stratford, isn't it? Okay,
yeah,
nice. Totally.
It's like a 15-minute walk away from where we are now. So, yeah.
You stressed out?
I'm trying to see it as an exciting opportunity for growth. Which I learned from researching The Expectation Effect, so we'll see if that works. But
yeah, tell us about the book then. I've been loving it. Tell me all about it.
Yeah, so it's called The Expectation Effect. It's all about the way our mindsets kind of influence our life. Everything from the placebo effect in medicine to kind of, like I mentioned, like the way we appraise stress can influence its kind of physiological effects on us, and the kind of, even down to our mortality, like there's this thing about if you're stressed, you're going to die young. But that's only true if you believe that stress is damaging your health. Even things like aging, how quickly we age biologically can depend to a certain extent on our kind of aging mindsets and whether we believe aging is a time of like decline and disability or whether it's kind of an opportunity for growth and new experiences.
Wow. That's quite amazing. Did you think about that? Did that go into your mind as an idea for a book, partly because of what's happening at the moment, the last couple of years with COVID? Because, I mean, how many times have you thought, like, oh God, I think I'm coming down with something. Can I taste right? I've heard I can't taste right. Have you had that a few times?
Yeah, yeah. And also with, like, vaccine side effects, you know, like, we know COVID vaccines definitely, like, a lot of the side effects are caused by, like, a biological reaction to the vaccine. But, you know, in about 50% of cases also, they're caused by expectations. So that's, like, a really powerful example of what's called the nocebo effect in medicine.
Yeah, 50%. That's because one of the things that I was reading in your book was that vaccinations, when you get like a flu jab, a lot of people think they get ill from the vaccination, but that's not how vaccinations work. But I'm pretty sure I got from the COVID one, I got the Johnson & Johnson thing, which was just a one. Luckily, I didn't have to have it twice. But I was a wreck. I was like shaking and shivering and going berserk. Surely that wasn't just because I expected that and it was in my mind.
No, I mean, probably it wasn't. So I think what we have seen with, basically with flu vaccinations, you know, they almost all the side effects, apart from the pain in your arm, are caused by expectation. You know, it's not like a very strong vaccination in that sense. It's like gently kind of priming your immune system. But the COVID vaccines, and it's partly what makes their immunity, the immunity afterwards, so effective, like they're really kind of stimulating your immune system. And so they are actually more likely to have like the quote unquote, like real side effects than say the flu vaccinations. But even so, if you look at people in the placebo arm of the clinical trials and they were just receiving salt water in that arm, still something like 25% of people there were reporting like headaches and fatigue and nausea and all of these things. So, you know, it's like almost with like almost anything in medicine, it's kind of a mixture of real biological effects and expectation on top of that.
Wow. Yeah, a friend of mine got very early on, either he got the vaccine or he got a fake placebo thing. I don't think we even know now, or maybe I need to ask him, maybe he does know. In fact, surely they would have to tell him now so he'd know whether to have to get the vaccine or not. But I remember he did have headaches and stuff and he was questioning like, but is it because of this? Or man, it's a really crazy thing. So what I guess one of the things that the book is positing is just this, well, not positing, it's just the fact that the placebo effect is very real and that we can sort of not just feel the effects, but we can become rather ill. And there are all these examples, as you say, of people dying. Oh, you know what, actually? The one bit that really stood out was right at the beginning. You talked about people with, sleep paralysis, right? I get sleep paralysis and it's awful, actually, because so it's do you get it, by the way?
No, I mean, I haven't so far, but I mean, the chances are everyone's going to experience it at one time in their life. So,
especially after me talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it sounds pretty terrifying. But yeah, I mean, do you find it a horrible experience?
Yeah, it's the worst thing in the world. It's like beyond, you can't even explain how bad it is because you just, and it happened last night to me, actually. And sometimes it won't happen for a year at a time or something. And then it will happen quite a few times within the space of a few weeks. And it's this thing where I sort of become aware that I'm no longer sleeping and I'm awake and my body is still paralyzed. But and for some reason with that, you have this like extreme anxiety and you feel like you can see things and a bit of hallucination. Horrible. But tell me that story about these people who were, it's going to make me even more scared of it, by the way, about these people who were actually dying because of it.
Yeah, so they were immigrants from Laos and they had this like a religious belief that when you experience sleep paralysis, that's like this evil demon. And this is common actually all over the world. This was this evil demon that is kind of sitting on your chest and it can kind of suck the life out of you. So obviously that's going to heighten your fear when you do experience sleep paralysis compared to if you can kind of reason that, you know, it's just a natural reaction to kind of waking up that happens occasionally. But I think what was key for these people was they were arriving in the United States and a lot of them, you know, with their kind of adjustment to the new society that they were living in, they'd started abandoning some of their previous like rituals, religious rituals that might have helped to protect them from this evil demon. So when they started experiencing this sleep paralysis, they were like even more scared than they would have been in Laos. And then that sometimes, in quite a few cases, actually promoted like a real life heart attack. And so you can see that then once that started happening amongst this very specific demographic of young men, young immigrant men, that the fear kind of spread. It was almost like a case of mass hysteria. And actually, like at one point in the 1980s, it was like the leading cause of death for these men. So, you know, like really serious. And the CDC were completely baffled by what was causing it. And it was actually a cultural anthropologist who managed to link it to this particular cultural belief.
Did they, do you know what happened next? Did they go around all these people saying, listen, your belief in this thing is ridiculous, stop it. I guess, what can you do with these people?
No, exactly. I mean, I think that helped probably, like having a better kind of scientific understanding of it. I think also just after a while, you know, these people probably just like became even better adapted to the kind of their new life. And maybe because when they didn't have the kind of underlying stress of also being like an immigrant in a new country, that could have also helped them to adjust. For these people, it was really a combination of everything. It was like they were suffering from like the incredible stress of having moved to a new continent. Then they were having this sleep paralysis, and that all of that together was then causing them to have these kind of heart problems.
My word. Imagine that. Just like, oh, because sometimes my girlfriend has to wake me up from it because I can sort of make noises. I can't move anything, but I can sort, and in my head, I'm screaming. Like in the dream, I'm going like Holy, wake me up. Her name's Holy, but I hope I don't get the name wrong because I'm half dreaming still, but I get a name right. Yeah. Wake me up. And then, but all she can hear is like, which is pretty scary for her. But imagine if I was actually having a heart attack. Bloody hell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and there are reports of people who could hear that kind of noise, like this kind of ghostly kind of scream, and they couldn't do anything about it until the person had died. But
oh my God, that's horrific.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really dark story, but I think it really does show how like how important our expectations and beliefs can be, and how like they can change our physiology in ways that we don't haven't understood previously.
It's really extraordinary. She wakes me up if she hears me, and it does wake me up. Like if she just grabs me. The unfortunate thing is because I told my friend Josh about this recently, and then he'd never had that in his life, and he started having sleep paralysis. So there's probably about 20,000 people listening to this. Don't get it. And if you do, it's not a real thing, and don't blame me. It's David's fault. Right. So in the book you talk also about food allergies. People get more food allergies and stuff like that. Is it because people are always saying, and sometimes it comes from a conservative place, do you know what I mean, like someone's stepmum or uncle or aunt is sort of, oh, weren't food allergies back in my day, but is there some sort of expectation effect going on?
Yeah, totally. And I think that's really important that, you know, when like scientists had studied expectation effects in the past, they had kind of thought, oh, it's these kind of culturally primitive people, you know, they'd actually used that language. And it's like, oh, we're a scientific society, like we're kind of totally immune to this. But actually, we're suffering from expectation effects of that kind all the time. And one of the most common is the kind of food allergies. So if you look at kind of gluten sensitivity or kind of wheat allergies, like there's no doubt that lots of people do have a kind of genuine allergy, in the same sense that, you know, lots of people were having genuine side effects of the kind of COVID vaccines. You know, like there's a real biological link there that kind of explains the symptoms very clearly. But actually, there's a lot of people who are experiencing these symptoms, but when you give them these kind of blinded tests, so you kind of give them a placebo food that doesn't include wheat or any gluten or any of the other kind of carbohydrates that are thought to cause the symptoms, that they still experience the kind of feeling of bloating, diarrhea, you know, whatever, like real symptoms, but it's just not being caused by the food itself. So it's coming from this kind of expectation effect. You know, you read about it a lot in the media. I think that hasn't helped. And actually, you do see that where there's more media coverage, it's more prevalent. So, you know, our media is kind of spreading these ideas, then having like serious effects on people's bodies and what they can eat.
Wow. And so it's not, and I think this is quite an interesting part of your book, is like, it's, they're not faking it, are they? They really do feel they are having the symptoms.
Yeah, that's totally it. And, you know, I've suffered from, we call these negative expectation effects, nocebo effects. And, you know, I've suffered from that myself. Like and it was kind of what prompted me to kind of write the book, was that I was on this course of like antidepressants and one of the kind of expected side effects is that you get really bad headaches. And so I had these kind of migraines that wouldn't go away. It was really difficult to work. It felt a bit like having like an ice pick kind of going through my head, like Trotsky style, you know. And because I was researching a journalistic article on the nocebo effect, I actually discovered that it's actually really rare for people to experience like headaches from the pills themselves. Like people in the placebo arms are just as likely to experience headaches. And so that was really telling me that actually it was my expectations that were causing it. And, you know, so I kind of read that in the morning, went out for lunch, came back, and my headache had like almost completely disappeared. But I know that like the pain I was feeling wasn't like imagined. And studies actually showed that, you know, you can see physiological changes in the brain with kind of hormones and neurotransmitters that are causing, they're changing the kind of dilation of your blood vessels that can cause the headaches. So it is a real effect, like it's a real symptom, just as much as if like I had taken a pill that was actually causing a chemical change in my brain, but it was just coming from my expectations, not from like a physical trigger.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts. This was your second book, was it? After The Intelligence Trap?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, you did talk about your own struggles with depression. I think it was 7 years ago you had a powerful depression. Was it hard sort of giving something of yourself into the book in that way? Did it come naturally to you?
It wasn't so hard because I don't really go into the details of, apart from just saying about that very specific side effect. And, you know, I was quite lucky in that I felt like I recovered from like my depression quite quickly, actually, with a combination of like the antidepressant pills and like CBT. And that all like ties in with the expectation effect too, because there's like loads of work showing that if you are more optimistic about the benefits of therapy, you're more likely to actually like recover during the therapy than if you kind of assume it won't work right from the beginning. So, you know, and I did try to take quite a positive attitude, but like there were small things I could change that would eventually help me to kind of recover from depression. And you know, I have like low moments, but I haven't really relapsed, I would say, since then.
Okay, well, that's good to hear that you know you're doing well. And I suppose that's why it's important to have a therapist that you like, isn't it? I often hear people talk about that with therapy. You got to, you know, chop and change sometimes, because if you like them, you're bound to feel more positive about the whole thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. This guy was like super helpful. And, you know, I mean, so it was done by phone, actually, because the NHS has to save money. But that worked fine. And I tried to have like a bit of a positive mindset about that too. Like, you know, you could feel like you're not getting the full kind of service, but I mean, it was fine. There was no real need for me to see him face to face, actually. So, yeah.
I've done Zoom therapy. So at least you got the video, but then the therapist, she didn't have a very clear camera. And I did say at one point, I was just like, what webcam do you have? And she sort of explained what it was. And then I didn't want to push anymore. I was just like, okay, that's all I said. I was hoping she would then think, oh, I do look a bit blurry, but she didn't. And, but I still liked her and it helps. But one thing I think therapy is really good and it's helped me a lot as well in the past. And I think a lot of people can do with it. And, but then one thing I worry about, and I think it relates as well to your book, is that my little sister's 14, and basically at her school, every kid has got like something because they're encouraged to talk about it. There's a lot of talking in the media, which obviously is a really good thing because they're in touch with their feelings and everything. That's how it should be. You don't want to have to repress stuff. But I do worry there's like almost an element of if you don't have, and this is the conservative part of my brain, the old reactionary brain is sort of going like, oh, it's a fashion, it's a fad. Like if you don't have something, then you're almost left out and left behind. I mean, do you worry about that? And in your book, there were a couple of examples as well, I think, of schools where like mass hysteria spread and people felt very real symptoms.
Yeah, I mean, and that's definitely happening. You know, like recently there's been this kind of people like showing the symptoms of Tourette's in the US because of like TikTok videos that are kind of showing the symptoms. And then, you know, it's kind of contagious through this kind of nocebo like expectation.
Scary.
Yeah,
that happened in South Park. Yeah. Did you see that South Park episode?
No, I didn't. I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Cartman does it. It was about 10 years ago this episode came out. Cartman starts doing it either he's making fun of someone, I can't remember, or he was trying to get some advantage from pretending he had Tourette's. And then it really did start to happen. And he was revealing things in his Tourette's that were very embarrassing for him that he didn't want to reveal.
Yeah, I need to check out that episode. I kind of wish I'd known that before I wrote the chapter. But yeah, I mean, you know, and again, these people aren't making it up either. And, you know, like a Havana syndrome in the US, well, with US diplomats, that's probably, you know, I'm going out on a limb here because there's no scientific consensus on what the cause is. But like quite a few neurologists think that it's kind of a psychogenic illness, you know, caused by negative expectations. But just because it's psychogenic doesn't mean that these people are like making it up, you know.
What's the Havana for people who don't know about it?
Yeah, so this is where like there were these kind of reports that like diplomats and kind of spies in Cuba were, they felt like there was this kind of weapon that was being directed at them from a distance that was causing things like dizziness, tinnitus. I mean, originally it was called this kind of sonic weapon because people often heard this kind of quite high-pitched sound around it. But then when someone took a recording of the weapon, people found it was the sound of cicadas instead.
What are cicadas?
Like, are they like crickets? Like,
oh, right. Yeah, I know. Okay,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, some kind of insect that kind of makes like a kind of humming sound, which I think can be like really loud and quite unpleasant. But I mean, when they did the acoustic analysis, it was clear it wasn't like a human-made weapon. It was the sound of these insects. So then they kind of, the idea was maybe it was some kind of radio wave weapon that was kind of focusing on their brains. But it, you know, like physicists are like super skeptical that such a weapon could be built, let alone that it could be kind of transportable and it could pass through walls and, you know, that you could hide all of this from like observers. So like, and for this reason, lots of neurologists think that actually these sound like a kind of psychogenic illnesses. And it's kind of like these diplomats, you know, were being harassed by the Cuban government. So it was already like a high stress environment. And then you had one patient who started developing symptoms, and then everyone else kind of started to assume that they were being targeted by this weapon as well. So it kind of spread to lots of people. And, you know, like, it's really like quite debilitating, apparently. Like, it's not something to laugh at. But I think what's weird to me is that a lot of the media coverage is just like, you know, even like kind of senators in the US are saying things like, it would be impossible for this to be psychogenic because you'd have to be such a consummate actor to be putting on these symptoms. But that's not what neurologists mean by psychogenic illness. It's like you're like the people with allergies, like with my headaches, like you're totally feeling the symptoms and showing the physical signs of the symptoms. But that's coming from this kind of mind-body connection. Where the brain is kind of creating the symptoms out of nowhere.
We all sort of prickle a bit if somebody suggests that our illnesses or symptoms might be... Is psychosomatic just a synonym for psychogenic?
I think there's like a very slight distinction in that psychosomatic could well be where like your expectations are kind of exacerbating an existing symptom, whereas I think psychogenic is where it's like wholly, completely caused by your expectations.
we do prickle a bit if someone's ill, and it is, I think it's, I don't know if this is just us, but like as a couple, if one of us has a headache, I guess you want your partner to not have the headache anymore. So you sort of, you'll be like, either look, we've got some painkillers here, so that'll be good, and you rest a bit. But then sometimes you might be like, you want them to get it into their heads that they might be imagining it. Because I guess we all do have that awareness that once you sort of, that some of it is psychological and psychosomatic. I should say about the Havana syndrome. Was it you that, because it was in your book, that in the expectation effect, it's, but did you write quite a long article about it a couple of months ago?
No, yeah, no, that must have been someone else. But there has been like a bit of coverage, and you know, like Suzanne O'Sullivan, the neurologist who specializes in psychogenic illness, she also like covers that in her latest book, Sleeping Beauties. And yeah, she's like absolutely convinced it's coming from kind of psychological origin. It's not caused by this kind of mysterious weapon. Yeah,
I was thinking of covering it for, because I'm writing a book at the moment about secrets, the effect of secret keeping, why you reveal secrets, why you keep them, what happens to you when you're holding on to too many difficult ones. And again, I was looking at that because these are obviously spies and agents and things who are holding on to secrets. And I think you mentioned as well, part of it could be the stress of the situation they're in. Some of that will be created by the secrets they're keeping.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I definitely think like personal stress is like lays the foundation for a lot of these psychogenic illnesses. And then it's like you often don't need much of a kind of trigger to then kind of cause them to manifest in different ways.
It's crazy, isn't it? So is the brain just this big prediction machine? Is anything real? And what is unconscious inference?
Yeah, so that was this, that's this kind of old idea, and it's, you know, but that turns out to be true, from Hermann von Helmholtz, who, you know, he was one of the first people to come up with this idea that we, when we're perceiving the world, actually, like the data coming into our senses is like super messy, you know, like we can't ever see what our retina is picking up, but it's not pretty, basically. And then the brain, because it's just so confused, you know, like, and then the brain has to kind of edit that data down into something that looks kind of meaningful, you know, like identifying the contours and kind of sharpening them, you know, working out perspective, like all of these things. It would be impossible just without any kind of processing to kind of build that kind of picture from what is on the, what light falls on the retina, because they're kind of, you know, 2D plates that are quite granular, you know, so a lot of work has to go into creating this kind of rich sensual experience that we have. And a lot of that comes from this kind of top-down processing. So, you know, as you grow up, like a baby probably does see like this kind of unfiltered view of the world. And then as we grow up, we've kind of built more memories and understanding of kind of how the world should look. And it's the brain is then using those kind of experiences to guide it's kind of visual editing, or it's kind of auditory editing, you know, for all of the senses. And then that it kind of produces a simulation of kind of what's most likely to be out there. And we see that simulation, we don't actually see the kind of raw data. And so that leaves us like vulnerable to perceptual expectation effects, where your expectations can cause you to kind of see a hallucination, you know, see kind of ghost, see a kind of ghost in the flames of the Notre Dame Cathedral, for example. Like right. Lots of people reported that, and that was an expectation effect, you know, unless you're religious and you think it was actually a sign from God. But yeah, it's all of that kind of thing, especially when the data is kind of ambiguous, the brain is kind of easily swayed by its expectations.
Man, wouldn't you like to see like the world as it is, even just for like an hour? Just the, I guess that's impossible for anyone to ever do, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I really think it is. I mean, I think sometimes people who've had strokes and they lose a lot of that visual processing, they do report something that seems, it's like where their vision just kind of breaks apart. And that's partly because they can't do this like predictive processing of the essential data.
Oh, that's awful though.
Yeah, exactly.
The closest thing I suppose is in your book, and it worked on Kindle as well, were these images where it looks like a big mess. And then you say afterwards, like a clue as to what it might be. And then when I see, then suddenly I can't, whenever I see it, I see forever what that is. Although there was one that I couldn't anyway. So I think my brain was bad. Yeah, I saw later.
Yeah.
I've got a rubbish brain. I couldn't see what it was. And it was like 10 pages later, or a few in the Kindle, because it's all a bit over. It was a few pages later. And then it showed, it was a dog that took up a lot of the picture. So I just wasn't expecting that. So again, but then once I saw that, if I go back, I can see it. You wrote obviously the intelligence trap about how we shouldn't trust the way we think. We go down these different segues and whatever. Expectation effects as well. Is the theme here that we shouldn't trust our own minds? Is that something that plays a big role in your life as well?
Yeah, no, it is. You know, I think there is this kind of common thread between the intelligence trap and the expectation effect. But, you know, we have to be more kind of questioning of our assumptions. And I'd say in the expectation effect, you know, especially when it comes to things like our stress mindsets, you know, like it's really natural because we've been told this a lot, that stress is just inherently damaging. And you just assume that's true. But actually, like the research shows, it's only true if you have this kind of mindset that stress is debilitating and damaging for your health. And if you assume that stress is actually energizing, then you show kind of different hormonal profile when you have to face this kind of, you know, difficult kind of challenge, like, you know, giving a speech or, you know, all of that kind of thing that's like really tough for most people to do. But if you're telling yourself that those feelings of anxiety are actually like, you know, it's pumping blood to your brain, which is helping you to think more sharply, and it's giving you a bit of energy in your performance. But actually just changing your mindset to that can actually be hugely helpful for, you know, changing your performance, but also your kind of physiological reaction. But like, I just think, you know, like we just assume that stress is bad and we don't question that. And I think that's what I'm really trying to tell people, is that sometimes the pessimistic view of stuff is actually like really irrational, and the optimistic view can be more rational. And I think we kind of have this kind of cultural bias against that it seems kind of smart to be cynical all the time. But actually, you know, sometimes like the cynical, pessimistic view of events is like no more rational than trying to take a kind of more qualified but optimistic view of what's happening.
So it's like, I guess you're always having this battle with your subconscious then. If you're telling yourself you've got a speech and you're going, I'm not nervous, I'm excited. I'm excited to do this. That's not nervousness. But then you're battling this voice at the back that's going, nah, you're rubbish at this, you're going to fail. I saw because I had to do a speech for the Bristol Humanist Society, and I saw Chris Hughes, who's a hypnotist, who was on this show as well. And he says, he's very open about it. He's like, look, this is not like some magic thing or anything like that. All he really did was sit me down and just say lots of very, very positive things for an hour about how brilliant I was going to be and how brilliant I was going to do. And it didn't really feel like anything different was happening. And then I just went and did the speech and I wasn't nervous at all. And I had, but before, that was my nightmare. That's why I wanted to see him. It's just crazy how well that worked.
Yeah, exactly. And I think with the kind of stress mindset stuff, like what's important to remember with that is that you're not trying to like suppress the feeling of anxiety, which, you know, if you took a kind of traditional view of positive thinking, you'd just be like, you know, like you'd just be telling yourself, I'm not anxious, I have to be calm. And that actually makes things worse. If you try to suppress like an anxious feeling, like it, you kind of rebound and you feel even worse. So this is more just telling you to like, to kind of accept the feeling, but to ask yourself whether it could actually mean something different from what you're expecting, whether actually like all of that arousal that you're feeling, like physiological arousal, is actually in some way beneficial. And so you don't necessarily have to like it. Like, it's not like you're fooling yourself into feeling something that's not true. You're just kind of questioning whether actually that could be useful for you. And it's that like small mental shift that is so powerful.
Oh, that's great. I'm filled with anxiety just listening to you talk. I'm just thinking about, I've got a friend's best man speech to do. It's not for like another 9 months, but I'm just thinking, okay, reframe that sort of positive. Okay, it's good to feel. You had two burglaries of people trying to force the lock. And that's mad. Is that why you're moving? Why is everyone burgling you?
Yeah. I have no idea. Yeah, it was quite weird. I mean, it hasn't happened since then. So that was like 2 years ago. You know, it was quite scary because it was so blatant as well. It's not like they were trying to be quiet. It's not like they checked if we were in or not. It was like at 10 o'clock at night, which isn't that early. I think we'd just been on holiday. Maybe they assumed the flat was still empty. And then I changed the locks because the first time they did actually manage to force the lock. And then the second time they They just tried but couldn't.
So did they get in the first time?
Yeah, but then they, like, my boyfriend, like, shouted out and they kind of left. So saw the kind of, because they'd managed to force, we have a chain on the door, so they'd, like, forced that off as well. But then, like, they hadn't actually had time to steal anything because we'd heard it before, like, you know, they entered. So.
Did you catch a glimpse of them?
Yeah, and they looked quite dweeby, to be honest. They were not, like, they weren't threatening figures. But I guess, you know, our stereotypes about burglars probably aren't, like,
yeah,
realistic. My head.
Like, those poor burglars, they get such a rough time. The stereotypes, yeah. Prejudiced, because I'm thinking of, like, Layer Cake or one of those bloke who married Madonna, Guy Ritchie, movie guys, yeah. Big burly, and it man, I'm sorry you went through that. I guess we can laugh now, because but that's a scary thing, because that's your one secure place, and they made a mockery of it. They smashed a door.
Yeah and it was, so that created this kind of expectation effect where, like, I would often, like, think I could hear the door being forced, you know, even when the sounds probably weren't very similar. So, you know, it could have been someone outside kind of just, like, unlocking their car. You know, our printer just randomly, like, decides to kind of shuffle about its, like, motors or whatever, like, I guess when it's updating its software or whatever. But, like, then I was, like, certain that someone was doing it. And but no, it was just, like, randomly, like, printing a blank sheet of paper. So, yeah. But that showed me how, like, important these expectations are in, like, shaping perception, because, like, to me it sounded identical to when, like, we were being burgled, because I had that kind of heightened anxiety.
I asked you a similar question last time, I think, because I'm doing these podcasts, I'm always learning these fascinating things. And then, I mean, are you quite an annoying boyfriend to be around? Are you always explaining things and, like, he just wants to be scared or something, and you're going, like, yeah, but it's the expectation effect, oh, it's the intelligence trap, what you've just fallen down, does that happen?
Yeah, totally. And especially with, like, doing exercise. So one of the expectation effects is that you can, it's like often our kind of assumptions of our physical fitness can then kind of change our physiological reaction to exercise. So, you know, if you kind of assume that your body is just not capable or cut out for doing the workout, then you actually find it, like, a lot harder. You know, that's measured in objective measures, like, your endurance on the treadmill, even things like the gas exchange in your lungs is kind of less efficient if you assume that you're not good at exercise. So, you know, I go to the gym quite regularly. I do all of these kind of, you know, like Tom Daley workouts online and stuff. My boyfriend just finds it super annoying if he can tell that I'm trying to, like, shift his expectations of fitness, I do all the time. Like, I'll be like, oh, you know, once you get to the gym, it'll actually be really fun and you'll, like, thank yourself afterwards. And he finds that super annoying.
Patronising.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I'm accused of that all the time. Really patronising. Oh, really? Yeah. But the same thing, because you're sort of like, you're pulling the threads and you're doing, you're like the puppet master, like, using all this stuff you've learned. Like, well, you know, actually, you'll actually enjoy the thing that I want to do as well, because, you know.
No, exactly. And, like, with my mother-in-law, I was like, because she's, you know, in her 60s now and doesn't do much exercise. And I was trying to do this kind of thing where, like, oh, you might be surprised by how much you can do. Like, lots of research shows that, you know, even, like, into your 60s and 70s, you can have, like, great physical health. And, like, my boyfriend was like, just stop there. He's trying psychology on you. Like, don't listen to a word that he's saying.
He's doing psychology. Oh, man.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
my mum's, like, about to turn 60 and she plays tennis quite a lot. So I think, you know. Yeah. Tell your mother-in-law that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In terms of this sort of psychological manipulating, so if you had a 15-year-old or 14-year-old girl, I'm going back to my sister and her friends and all of that, and a lot of them are suffering, especially because there's been COVID as well. They've had, it's almost unprecedented, the psychological effects of, like, these 12 to 15-year-old kids who have got, like, had, like, a year of sitting at home and not knowing what they're doing, you know, all the uncertainty and stuff. So it's difficult. And then there's that part of me that's also going, yeah, but maybe you don't have that anxiety or whatever it might be to some of the kids. How would you go about speaking to them? Because that's quite, I don't expect you to have an answer to this exactly, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. And I think, like, you know, like Suzanne O'Sullivan, in fact, says that often, like, psychogenic illnesses are, like, the hardest to treat because people are so resistant to the idea that it could be a psychological origin. You know, so they often, you know, like, because there's lots of these kind of functional neurological disorders that I discuss one in my book, where like someone went blind because they had kind of developed this expectation that they couldn't see. Or, you know, you have people with like kind of functional epilepsy that doesn't have this kind of obvious biological cause, but it's caused by kind of expectation again. And, you know, like, so these people often are undergoing like really intense like medical procedures, like trying to look for the answer, when actually like they could respond really well to psychological therapy. So it's quite difficult to kind of open people's minds. But I think the first thing that has to be done is to just like remove the stigma around like psychogenic illness, because, you know, even people in the medical profession, if they don't specialize in that, they have all of those ideas that, oh, it's like made up, it's not real, like the symptoms don't really exist, like it doesn't matter. But it really does. So I think like using like whatever language you can to like show that actually there should be no stigma attached to this. And I feel like with mental health in general, we're like getting better at being kind of open and like destigmatizing that. And I think we just need to do the same, you know, when like, say, these psychological problems are manifesting in like less well-known ways. So yeah, like reducing the stigma, kind of using examples of people who have recovered and like getting them to share their experiences. I think all of that could be like super useful.
I think, I mean, you and I so far on this episode have both spoken about going to therapy ourselves. And I don't think that makes us seem any weaker. I think it makes us seem stronger, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, the truth is that, like, you know, we're, I think it still is a minority of people who have like a diagnosed psychological problem. But I mean, it's like a big minority, you know, it's not unusual. So I think like emphasizing that fact that you're not kind of isolated in this condition is really important.
Yeah, there is that. And then, like I say, I don't know, I get concerned because there's, I guess this is both sides, aren't there? Because there's that other side, as I was saying before, if we keep telling everyone like everyone has something and then they start to think they have stuff. Should the media play down, for example, the effects of COVID rather than play it up? Would that make people feel better? Then I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think we should be misleading people in either direction. And I think that's always the difficult line to kind of tread, is how can you be like totally objective? But say, you know, with like the vaccine side effects, which, you know, we know like some are kind of real in inverted commas, others are like caused by expectation. I felt like there was just a lot, especially on social media, of everyone sharing how bad their experience was. And maybe we didn't see so many people saying like, I was totally fine, which could seem a bit braggy.
Yeah.
In a way, it's like, like you shouldn't.
Why would you tweet it?
Yeah, exactly. But on the other hand, like, it's quite important for people to know that, you know, it's not inevitable. So I think that kind of thing, maybe in the way that the media even kind of frames things like side effects, it could be different. So, you know, if it is like 25% of people kind of suffering from like a real side effect, you could also like frame that as saying 75% of people, you know, get along totally fine without any kind of problems. And that, just like phrasing it in that way, actually can be quite potent in like reducing these kind of negative like nocebo expectation effects, because you're kind of raising people's expectations that, you know, chances are they'll be fine.
One of my closest friends refuses to get the vaccine. And he just says, like, look, he's very fit and healthy, and he said, I'm just going to stay healthy and exercise a lot. Why do I have to put this in my body?
Yeah, I mean, my mum's the same. Well, and my brother, who kind of brainwashed her, but that's a different story. But yeah, like, they're both like complete. They were COVID deniers, and now they're vaccine deniers. But I mean, I just, like, every time I see my mom, I try to be like, oh, have you got the vaccine yet? Like, and just kind of gently suggest it, because I know if I try to go into the facts, like, she will become more kind of resistant. So I also think, like, with that kind of person, actually, like, just talking about all the people you know who have had the vaccine can be quite powerful if you kind of make it clear that it's the norm to have the vaccine. You know, and actually, ironically, like when I think in the US, they found that if you emphasize how rare it is or how difficult it is to get the vaccine, then people are like, oh, wow, it must be special. Like, I have to go and get that now. So there are some ways. Yeah.
That's South Park as well. They did a recent I like my cartoons, South Park and Simpsons. And they did a recent episode where they did have that. It was like a club that you can try to get into to get the vaccine. They did that whole metaphor. See, they're on the ball. They've got, they know what they're...
Yeah, they know their psychology.
Yeah, I think that they are smart people. Tell me about those two presidents died on the same day, or 50th anniversary of Independence Day. What was that about?
Yeah, so it was John Adams and Thomas Jefferson both died on the same day, which was like the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So, you know, a momentous occasion for both of them. And then a crazy coincidence that they both died on the exact same day. You know, people at the time were like, oh, maybe this is a sign of, like, you know, God blessing the United States of America. You know, I feel like you could hear that today if the same thing happened, actually.
Sure.
But you know, like, scientists kind of suspect that there could be this kind of expectation effect going on where, like, because it was such a, you know, profound moment for their lives, that anniversary. And you know, like, when you look at these huge kind of longitudinal studies of people, you find that they are kind of more likely, slightly more likely to die on kind of big occasions like their birthdays, or on like the new year. Like, there was an especially big peak in the turning of the millennium. And like, the idea is just that, like, you know, we're not, it's more just like, if you're suffering from a chronic illness, like, your brain can kind of just try to help you to kind of, like, to drag you over that kind of final landmark point, you know, just like, and then it's like afterwards, it's kind of giving up on its will to live a little bit. So, which is affecting your physiology so that you're just more likely to die kind of on or just after that event. And so that's the suspicion that that was happening with these presidents.
That's crazy, isn't it? This idea that, because you always hear, like, in movies and stuff, and it's become a bit cliche of, like, he's just given up, or he has no more will to live. And I used to think, oh, what a load of nonsense. But it's interesting to hear there is really a physiological reason for that. I think Shakespeare died on his birthday. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's quite a few kind of, I can't remember many of them apart from these presidents. But yeah, it's quite common among, like, in, like, a kind of the biographies of famous people or historical figures, that, yeah, you know, that kind of thing does happen.
23rd of April, 1616. I'm just reading that. That's not in my head. Yeah, he was 52. He was quite young, actually.
Yeah.
Poor guy. He'd be dead now anyway, though. And then, because that reminds me a bit of, like, you know, exams and stuff. When I was a kid, I used to always get ill after doing exams. And it was like you're sort of holding it off almost. And then you're going, oh, and then you let yourself get ill.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, it's very similar, I think, that you know, like, the mind can't perform, like, actual miracles. But there are things that it could do with, like, changing the kind of inflammatory response or blood pressure, you know, all of these kinds of things that could just be, that could, like, affect kind of the precise moment that you die.
That's crazy. I think I was thinking, there's so much stuff when I was reading this, I was thinking about The Exorcist that I interviewed, because he obviously helped these people and they were better for quite a long time, like, actually much better for like a good year or so after being exorcised. I thought about when I was at university, and I remembered this particular time I came home from a party, just like staggering home, and like couldn't get the key in the door, trying to open the door, and I was just like a complete mess, just like, oh, bloody hell, I'm not going to feel good in the morning. And only as I sort of opened the door and walked through did I remember I hadn't had a drink that night.
Really?
Yeah, just everybody else had. They were all drunk, so everyone around me was drunk, so I just had hours of being around that.
Yeah.
And I guess I had, would that be an example of the expectation effect of me just expecting that I was drunk?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, I haven't included that in my book, but I have just written a piece with the BBC about this, actually, that a lot of our drunk behaviour is caused by expectation rather than the kind of physiological effects. And so what's weird about alcohol is that it's actually, it's kind of like a kind of mood suppressant. Like, it's a downer, basically. But loads of the things that we associate with alcohol, like becoming more extroverted or kind of gregarious and aggressive, like, those are things that you'd expect from, like, stimulant drugs. So scientists have always suspected that, well, maybe it's actually our expectations that kind of, it's like a placebo effect that's causing us to change our behavior rather than the actual kind of chemical. And that's just what they found. Like, they had all of these, like, ingenious experiments where they kind of gave people kind of mocktails that were like super realistic, and then those people were like, you know, like super mean to like the other people in the group because they kind of expected that the alcohol would let them become a bit more kind of aggressive or rude. You know, other times, like, they would kind of get them to like record a video of themselves, like a kind of fake advert, and look back at it. And like, these people were like, if they thought they'd had alcohol, they were like, oh yeah, I'm brilliant. I'm like, you know, like they had all of that kind of self-enhancement that you have when you have a drink and you're like cock of the walk, even if they'd had like this like alcohol-free mocktail. So yeah, it's so quite funny. Powerful.
Happens the other way as well. My girlfriend often accuses me of stealing her period. There'll be a few days of the month when I'm a bit down and I'll be a bit low and I'll want sort of more attention and I'll be a bit needier and stuff. And I don't know if part of that's also just to so that I'm the one that gets looked after, even though it's her period, you know, that's, which is probably very selfish of me. Or if I'm sort of, and there is that thing, isn't there? And again, I'm just anecdote. I hardly even know if this is a true thing. There's that rumor that women tend to synchronize when they're together.
I don't know if that's true, actually. Yeah.
Have you heard that?
Yeah, I have. I mean, like, I think it's often taken as like, as the truth. Yeah, I'm not sure if it is nonsense though. Yeah, maybe it is. Yeah,
I have no idea. I think it's probably that when it does happen, it gets talked about, and then it's, you know, they don't talk about all the times it hasn't happened.
Yeah, exactly. It's that like availability bias or whatever.
What is, tell me about like mirroring, and how do you pronounce these monkeys that I've read the name of them for like my whole life and I never had to pronounce them? Is it macaques?
Yeah. So they, you know, like in the 1990s, this Italian group of researchers were like trying to understand like the neural code of like how neurons respond when we kind of perform actions. So they had this kind of monkey with electrodes in his brain. And it was like, you know, they were recording like when it was picking up its peanuts or like playing with a toy. And, you know, they saw that there was this kind of repeated like, signal that they saw each time it performed a certain action. It was like they could identify what it was doing just from like the electrical activity of the brain. But then I think this is apocryphal, this particular part of the story, that a graduate student then walked in to the lab like eating an ice cream, and then they saw the same the kind of same pattern of activity in the monkey that they would normally expect when it was eating a treat. And so it looked like it was kind of mirroring the, it was like imagining in such detail that it was identical to the actual activity that it should have been feeling. Anyway, they did loads of experiments to actually check that was true, and it was true. So when the monkey was picking up a peanut, or if it saw someone else picking up a peanut, you saw the same pattern of activity. So these were called mirror neurons. And we don't know exactly if like the mechanism in the human brain is exactly the same, but we do know there's this kind of mirror system. So the same general areas for certain like kind of light up when we observe something or when we do it ourselves. And that's also true for emotions. If you see someone feeling happy, like, you know, you have the same kind of activity in your brain. It's kind of much weaker, but it is there. And so that's partly how kind of feelings are so contagious. So there's other mechanisms. It can't explain all kind of human empathy, but it does kind of lay a foundation for empathy and kind of our tendency to mirror each other's actions and feelings. And so that could help us to understand how, say, like the symptoms in the people suffering from Havana syndrome kind of spread between all of the different diplomats. Because if you see someone else kind of in a lot of pain, you're kind of, you've got this neural signal that's kind of priming you to feel the same. And if you then add to that this kind of expectation that there's this kind of weapon that's going to be you know, fired at your head to kind of give you a terrible headache or to give you tinnitus or whatever, then, you know, it's just enough to actually kind of create like a strong enough signal in the brain that you're actually feeling it yourself.
Must be tough for like doctors and psychiatrists and stuff always being around ill or psychologically unwell people. I wonder if there's been studies on that, like if they get quite low dealing with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm pretty certain they do. I think there had been like a study of doctors, of surgeons, that had found that they do seem to have learned to kind of like dump down that response, so they can like turn off their empathy a bit when they're performing surgery, which I feel kind of reassured by, because you don't want a surgeon to be like freaked out every time they cut into you.
I hope that was everything that you were expecting. The expectation effect is out in all the normal places. Like right now, it's just come out. It's out like today, I think. If you're listening to this on the launch day of this episode on the 3rd of January, 2022, I think David's books come out like today or tomorrow. You can, if it's tomorrow, you can pre-order it. But go and have a look for it on Amazon and all the places. It's in the show notes. Can you believe we're in 2022? We're in 2022 and David Robson's written his second book, The Expectation Effect. It's all ridiculous. We're in the future. It was a great pleasure to speak to David again. Follow him on D_A_Robson or just type David Robson on Twitter. I'm AndrewGold_OK there on Twitter and on Instagram. Get our bonus chat on patreon.com/AndrewGold on Apple. On Patreon at the time of writing, 10 days before this is set to come out, the Patreon is up to £297. And I'd love to break through £300 as I get closer to doing this for a living. And you guys, if you sign up, you'll get your ads-free episodes and bonus episodes and all that. I've recorded this, what I'm saying now, before Christmas Day even and before New Year's Eve. So I don't have new reviews and Patreons and patrons and things to tell you about. Coming up next week is John Ronson. And again, if you're wondering if that was John saying his name for me, no, that was me doing a quite wonderful impression. But I cannot wait to drop that one on you. He'll be talking about his new podcast, Things Fell Apart. The following week is the one, the only, Richard Dawkins. I won't be doing an impression of his voice, lest he scold me. But he's a, if you don't know already, you've been living under a rock. He's a renowned scientist and atheist known for The God Delusion, among many other works. He also had his humanist status, or the Humanist of the Year award, removed by some people because he said there are only two sexes or some such thing. It's very controversial. I did ask him about that very briefly, that which was very scary to do. And yes, as I say, the scariest interviewee to date. And I've interviewed psychopaths. And I don't think Richard is one. He was actually very lovely. But it's just if you say something that's not entirely accurate or right, he will pick you up on it. And why shouldn't he? Have a lovely new year. Thanks for sticking with On the Edge with Andrew Gold into 2022. It's been a wild 18 months since I started this in May of 2020. And here's to another year of scary, crazy, bizarre, and hopefully educational and informative interviews. And may all your wishes for the year come true. I can't wait to have you here next week with John Ronson.